It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Many religious conservatives see Sarah Palin as one of their own. Her evangelical credentials have helped them get behind John McCain's bid for the presidency. Palin's background is in the Pentecostal church. And as NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports, what Palin has revealed about her religious beliefs offers a glimpse of her worldview.
On June 8, Alaska's governor dropped in on Wasilla Assembly of God, a Pentecostal church she and her family attended until 2002. During the service, she addressed a group of young missionaries, and at the end, she said she had a word from the Lord for them. She prayed that Jesus would give them a spirit of wisdom and revelation.
And that spirit of revelation also, including that spirit of prophecy, that God's going to tell you what is going on and what is going to go on. And you guys are going to have that within you, and it's just going to bubble up and bubble over, and it's going to pour out throughout the state of Alaska.
When I listened to the tape, it seemed to me like she's the real McCoy.
That's Margaret Paloma at the University of Akron, who's written several books on Pentecostalism and is Pentecostal herself. She says the words in Palin's prayer, divine revelation, prophecy, and outpouring of the Holy Spirit are hallmarks of this brand of Christianity. Palin now goes to a non-denominational Bible church when she's in Wasilla, but her years attending Pentecostal churches, including the one she currently attends in Juneau, have no doubt shaped her faith and possibly her view of world events. For example, here's Palin speaking of the war in Iraq.
Pray for our military men and women who are striving to do what is right also for this country, that our leaders, our national leaders, are sending them out on a task that is from God. That's what we have to make sure that we're praying for, that there is a plan and that plan is God's plan.
Some people would hear that and go, she thinks this is a holy war, or Pentecostals think this is a holy war. Is that fair to say?
I would think it's fair to say, yes.
One reason, Margaret Paloma says, is that many Pentecostals believe that Islam is a false religion.
Many times you hear it referred to as a kind of diabolical religion, and that comes in from their idea of Christianity being the true religion, but also their support for Israel, because they contend that Israel is God's chosen people and you dare not touch them.
Paloma says this points to a central belief that there is a cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil. It was language Palin used when accepting the nomination on Wednesday night when she spoke of the war on terrorism. And it was language used by Palin's current pastor, Mike Rose, at Juneau Christian Center.
Have you ever felt that way about the devil, the ultimate terrorist? Like, you know, I'm just really tired of this spiritual warfare. I'm done with it. Well, you know what? He never quits. So whether you and I like it or not, we are going to be in spiritual warfare.
Pentecostals believe God routinely intervenes in human affairs. Sarah Palin sounded like a Pentecostal when she asked people at Wasilla Assembly of God to pray about building a gas pipeline through Alaska.
I think God's will has to be done in unifying people and companies to get that gas line built. So pray for that.
Daryl Bach, a New Testament scholar at Dallas Theological Seminary, says some Pentecostals hold to their convictions in the face of opposition because they believe that they are in tune with the will of God.
What faith does in this case is to fuel a sense of mission and direction. It can also produce a little bit of element of certainty about that direction.
But Bach warns against drawing conclusions about anyone's policies from his or her faith.
Trying to figure out what the link is between a person's faith and their politics is very, very difficult business because there is so much pragmatically and ideologically that's also driving what's going on. There's not just the faith element.
Bach says President Bush and Democratic nominee Barack Obama have already been through this sort of spiritual vetting. Now it's Sarah Palin's turn. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
One person's viewpoint about Sarah Palin has been spreading rapidly. It's an email written by a woman named Anne Kilkenny. NPR's Martin Costi has gone to the email's source in Wasilla, Alaska.
The email in question is sort of a Sarah Palin primer for non-Alaskans. We're not going to get into the substance of the email here. Suffice it to say, it's critical of Palin and sharply written. So sharp that it's left some bloggers wondering, who is this Anne Kilkenny, really?
Anne Kilkenny is a resident of Wasilla, Alaska, and I wrote an email to some friends that went viral.
Kilkenny is real. She's a stay-at-home mom who lives in a house with a view on a backyard bursting with raspberries. She hasn't had any time to pick those raspberries this week. not since her friends in other parts of the country started emailing her questions about Sarah Palin.
I was just going to address the whole thing, write one letter and send it out, and then we could just let it lie, and I would go on with my life. What a silly thing to think.
She wrote her friends, "Go ahead and forward this email if you want, but please don't let it leak out onto the web." Yeah, it was on the blogs in a matter of hours. Now it's everywhere. Just try Googling Ann Kilkenny.
I'm not sure exactly what a blog is. I think it's some kind of conversation or something. I don't do IM either. Heck, we only have a dial-up connection.
This is a dial-up connection is the source of all this trouble. And now her inbox is filling up with responses, and fast. She checks the day's count.
Oh my gosh, I now have 1,014 in my inbox. I refreshed it. It grabbed another couple hundred.
It jumped from 790 to 1,000 in a minute. You're a popular woman.
And there's the phone.
An interest has spilled out beyond the internet. During our 20-minute interview, Kilkenny was interrupted with calls from NBC, the St. Petersburg Times, and People magazine.
This is the quiet time of day, believe it or not. 4 o'clock in Alaska is 8 o'clock on the East Coast. They've all either made or missed their deadlines, and they've given up. And so it's now just the foreign press.
Kilkenny did more than just write an email. She became a rare resource, a longtime resident of Wasilla who was willing to criticize Sarah Palin on the record, and that made her useful to curious outsiders. The phones have been ringing just as much at the homes of other Palin critics here in Alaska, but those people are mostly politicians. They're used to this kind of attention. For a civilian like Kilkenny, it's been a rush.
I'm in the middle of an interview right now. Can you call me back? Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Are you starting to regret this?
No, it's not going to last.
As she says this, she's holding her phone in her hand, waiting for it to ring again. And suddenly she seems a little wistful. Martin Costi, NPR News, Wasilla, Alaska.
When the Miss America pageant was held in Atlantic City 40 years ago this weekend, some people were there to watch and others to protest. This was the first major demonstration of the emerging women's liberation movement. As part of our series Echoes of 1968, we're taking a look back at the day when the media began referring to feminists as bra burners. The term was not quite accurate, as we find out listening to four people who were there. One of them was Miss America 1968. The others, including this woman, were protesters.
My name is Alex Kate Shulman. When I was growing up, Miss America was the symbol of what every young girl wanted to be.
The Miss America pageant means many things to many people. For the millions of you watching tonight on television, it means 2 hours of entertainment, glamour, and excitement.
My name is Carol Hanisch. As a teenager, I always watched it. Our whole family watched it together. In those days, it was taken quite seriously.
As we meet them now in swimsuits, Miss Tennessee.
You know, I hadn't watched it. My parents hadn't even had a television set until I was 15. But whether you had watched it as a kid or not, it affected every woman's life.
And you will see yourself as you have always wanted to be.
I took the name Kathy Sarah Child in 1968. I heard the phrase women's liberation back then, and I immediately began to think, women's liberation? Could there be a women's liberation movement like the civil rights movement?
It's a new me, if ever I knew me.
We'd been discussing how we were oppressed by beauty standards, and then one night we were watching a movie. It had Miss America parading in her bathing suit. And it got me thinking that protesting the pageant might be a good way to launch the movement, because up to this time, we hadn't done a lot of actions yet. We were a very small movement.
We had rented a couple of buses. It was a beautiful day. We got there. We started assembling. Everybody had her assignment.
It was kind of a gutsy thing to do, you know. Miss America was like this American Pie icon. You know, who would dare criticize this?
My name is Deborah Barnes Snodgrass. I was Miss America 1968. I was crowned actually in September of 1967 and then returned to Atlantic City to crown my successor. what I saw was women in front of the convention hall, and they had picket signs, and they talked about the Miss America pageant being a meat show and an auction.
Yes, sirree, boys, step right up. How much am I offered for this number one piece of prime American property?
And they had this big Miss America kind of doll, bigger than life size, and it wasn't very flattering.
You can get this standard quality model wherever.
The things that we did on the boardwalk were all outrageous, audacious, and filled with glee.
To come join, fight, don't be no Miss America no more.
Our biggest, most notorious action was throwing what we called instruments of female torture into what we called the Freedom Trash Can.
So we threw girdles and hair curlers and pots and pans and Playboy magazine and bras and whatever we could think of.
We had intended to burn it, but the police department, since we were on the boardwalk, wouldn't let us do the burning. But, you know, the media picked up on the bra part. I often say that if they had called us girdle burners, that every woman in America would have run to join us.
One of the things that we decided to do was to try and get some people inside and unfurl this banner, which was really just a bedsheet, that said women's liberation.
Let us give one final salute to Debbie Dean Barnes, Miss America of 1968.
When the outgoing Miss America got up to give her speech, we started moving toward the balcony.
I will make way for Miss America 1969 to search for her special someday. But even though I will be sad to see, to leave all these precious friends that I have made here in Atlantic City.
This was this woman's big moment, and I hated to interrupt her. You know, I was very much in the, you don't interrupt people, you be nice. At that point in my life, it was difficult. But then as soon as we did it, it felt great.
Newspapers covered it widely, and after that, women just flocked to meetings. We did not want to attack Miss America, not at all. We wanted Miss America to come and join us.
They should have asked me. No, I wouldn't have. I would never have joined in with that at all. I had a very high ideal of the Miss America pageant, that it was a scholarship pageant and not a beauty pageant. But now that I realize what the women's liberation movement was actually about, then I see that I have reaped some of the benefits of what they were trying to say. I think it was a poor choice to try to say it in that way, but I can get a charge card myself. I don't have to have a husband sign for that. I bought a car 2 months ago myself.
Women's lives are much easier in many ways today than they were 40 years ago. Young women have come through the doors that our generation opened, but I'm not sure they fully are grasping their situation any more than we did before we began to grasp ours. We're still not liberated because we're not treated as man's equal yet. We could certainly use another protest. If I could think of one, I'd certainly be doing it. I hope somebody does.
Alex Kate Shulman, Carol Hanisch, Kathy Sarachild, and Deborah Barnes-Snodgrass were interviewed by NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce. Now, forget about the presidential candidates for a moment, if you would, because for the past 2 weeks, we've been bringing you a series called Take Me to Your Leader. NPR's David Green has been traveling the country trying to understand how people define leadership. And a listener, Mike Morrow, emailed David to say the trip would not be complete unless David visited Walsh, Colorado, population 700.
I can't tell you how quickly Walsh would fly by if you were driving across the empty grasslands of southeast Colorado and didn't need to stop for a coffee or a soda. But we had an appointment to meet Dr. Bob Morrow, whose son wrote us that email.
I'd like to welcome all of you here. I'm just amazed that you would come to our little community. We're usually kind of on the outskirts of the edge of the world, we think sometimes.
Dr. Morrow's a dentist, former mayor, former fire chief, current city council member, and he's county coroner, and there are downsides to holding that job in a small community. Dr. Morrow remembers being on duty as coroner in the 1990s, and he was dispatched to his mother's house.
My foster mother, yeah. Yeah, but, you know, she just passed away naturally, and she was at the kitchen table.
He said this comes with the territory.
Here it's going to happen on a frequent basis. You're going to know a lot of the individuals that you have to respond to. And so.
And you had to go and literally be the one to pronounce your mom dead, that passed away.
Right.
Oh, God. That.
Yeah.
That was an impossibly hard day for Dr. Morrow, but he remembers the sense of duty, a feeling that he had a job that day, so that was that. And for a place this small to survive, it seems to take a lot of people willing to wear different hats and step up. It's the kind of leadership Mike wrote about in that email he sent, the reason he asked me to come to Walsh in the first place.
Hey, how you doing?
How are you?
Good, how you doing?
Okay, man, what in the world you got there?
Doing a little radio report about Walsh.
Well, that's all right.
Dr. Morrow brings us to the corner grocery store. About 2 years ago, the company that owned the store said they were closing down and moving out. For a time, that meant a half-hour drive out of town to shop. That's when the community took over. A group of residents came together, formed a co-op, and sold $50 shares around town. And the store reopened.
We have all the dairy products, the ice creams, the TV dinners, all up and down this aisle here on this side.
Rick Mills heads the grocery store's board. He also owns the auto supply store on Main Street. The grocery store, he says, brought in more than $1 million in its first year. It's been the engine of the little economy.
Once the dollars leave, they don't come back. And they're gone to the city, and that's where they stay. The people from the big city aren't going to come to Walsh, Colorado to do their grocery shopping or any other type of shopping as far as that goes.
A few blocks away, Dr. Morrow brings us to see his wife, Dolly. She teaches in Walsh's K-12 school system. She's also known in town for starting the Walsh Art Center.
You do have a feeling of empowerment in a small community, and that may sound silly, but it's true.
She says she may not have been able to swing an art center in a larger city.
You get all bogged down by the bureaucracy and the theys and thems and everything else. And when it's the us and the we, I feel like that's much more powerful.
Dr. Morrow has this massive metal ring with keys that seem to open every building in town. He takes us to the town's small theater where his wife's organization runs performances. The doctor takes us to see the firehouse, city hall. This is a tour he's proud of.
This community refuses to die, and that's why it's still here. It was moved here when the railroad came, and it should have been gone a long time ago, but these people, they love each other, and they're not going to die.
Dr. Bob Morrow and the people of Walsh, Colorado. I'm David Green, NPR News.
On this morning after the Republican convention, we would like to pause to remember one word in politics that's gotten a lot of attention this week.
There's no doubt that John McCain has been truly a maverick.
I think McCain is known as a maverick, and that's why I love McCain.
McCain is back to, I'm a maverick, I'm an independent.
If he can sell this as a maverick who picked another maverick.
Statements from the convention and the days before. We picked word maven William Safire to tell us where the term in his political dictionary, came from. It was the name of a Texas rancher in the 1800s, Samuel Maverick.
He refused to brand his cattle, and the reason he gave was he didn't want to be cruel to animals. But all his friends and neighbors said that wasn't so. He was just going around trying to round up all the unbranded cattle and claim them for himself.
Mr. Maverick was a conservative Southern politician who signed the Texas Declaration of Independence. His great-grandson lives in Los Angeles. Self-described city slicker Andrew Maverick, who likes hearing tales of his great-grandfather and those unbranded calves that roam freely in Texas.
When people around there saw a calf running around without a brand on it, when no mother, they say those are mavericks.
But the one who wears the name says it doesn't apply to him.
I'm a pretty bad conformist, I'm afraid.
Andrew Maverick on Morning Edition from NPR News.
This week at the Republican convention, one recurring theme was this: America is at war, and it needs a qualified commander-in-chief. Commentator Ken Harbaugh is a former Navy pilot, and he wants voters to understand the unique power a president can exercise as commander of America's military.
Last night, Senator John McCain delivered an acceptance speech in which he reiterated his qualifications to be commander-in-chief. Senator Barack Obama's speech last week was equally emphatic about his ability to lead our armed forces. Should we, as a nation, focus so much energy on just one part of what it means to be president? Yes. Being commander-in-chief is the most important job a president has. I know that might sound like one voter's vanity. I grew up in a military family. I joined the Navy after college. I am what you might call a military voter. Why should my issue matter most? The truth is that I and my military buddies do care about a variety of issues. But on everything else, schools, jobs, healthcare, executive power is balanced by the other branches. Even foreign policy and defense spending are worked out with Congress. When the commander-in-chief orders Americans to die for their country, there is no real check and balance. That authority is constitutionally protected. When we choose a president, we give one person almost unbridled military power. Short of impeachment, there's not a lot we can do to take it back. That's why, even in hugely unpopular wars, presidents are able to exercise powers unimaginable elsewhere in government. As a military voter, I know I'm outnumbered. Most of my fellow citizens have never served in uniform. I believe, however, that this is one of America's greatest strengths. Think about it. The world's most powerful military commander is a civilian, chosen almost entirely by other civilians. What then makes a good commander-in-chief? It's not always prior military service. Some of our best wartime leaders never wore a uniform. Judgment matters at least as much as experience, as does integrity and temperament. I suppose this is where I identify the best candidate. I'm not going to do that. Our system depends on each voter exercising their own judgment. That's collective wisdom, and it is what makes democracy work. It's not enough, however, to know the candidates, their strengths and their weaknesses. Voters must also understand the powers of the office, and none is greater nor more unrestrained than those of commander-in-chief. That's not just one voter's vanity. That's the Constitution. Come November, when you enter that voting booth, remember that the lives of our men and women in uniform depend on who sits in the Oval Office. It falls to us to choose a leader worthy of commanding them. In the end, we are all military voters.
Ken Harbaugh is executive director of the Center for Citizen Leadership. That's a nonprofit that helps wounded veterans work as community volunteers.